All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Well, hello and welcome to the Actual Anarchy Podcast. This is the podcast where we talk about movies from a Rothbardian and anarcho-capitalist perspective. And tonight is our Christmas episode, and that can mean only one thing. We're talking about the Crusades, and we're doing Kingdom of Heaven Director's Cut with our buddy Mike C. He's been on with us many times in the past. He did It's a Wonderful Life around Christmas time last year, so what a great follow-up for this year. But you can find the show notes and more for this at actualanarchy.com/212, and we wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Robert. I'm going to go over to you and check in with you. How are things going over there?
Yeah, what's up, honeys? $2 bill here, ready to make the money, get the cash, handed it over. Legitimate, voluntary gambling style winnings for me. I encourage everyone to bet Daniel. He's terrible. He doesn't know anything about sports. So if you know him, like, bet him something, anything, and he will take the most ridiculous bet and you'll just rake it in, just rake in the cash. And his destitution, I mean, his family, they'll be okay. You know, his wife can remarry to somebody who actually makes an income and isn't terrible at gambling. And then Daniel, he'll be out on the street, but, you know, he can just go to Seattle or Portland or LA, and they treat homeless people very, very well. You get your own, like, shoot 'em up needles. You get free meals. I'm sure that there's, like, tents and cardboard that he can appropriate for his own living quarters. And he's going to be just fine. Don't you worry about him. He can, you know, shack up in one of these autonomous zones, and then his communism will just be right at home. And he can just, tweach according to his need from his ability. And his ability is to be very bad at sporting bets. And that's why I cash it in. $2 bill, baby. Cha-ching.
Right. And we've already established that I'm bad at getting my camera to work with this streaming software. So for whatever reason, I'm failing at many areas of life. And if I do become destitute and need to live on the streets, there is now a ban on one of the insulating materials that I might use to waterproof said abode that I make on the side of the street with a refrigerator box. And that is the new ban on plastic bags that has just gone into enforcement, as you have alerted me to this today from Herr Inslee. Any comments on that?
Yeah. So I was doing some shopping, as I do. And the clerk was like, piling all my food into these giant plastic bags, like this, just enormous ones that I'm not used to. Usually you get the little ones that they spread out your food into. And I inquired as to what was going on. And she said, yeah, no more plastic bags. That these were the reusable bags that they sell normally for 50 cents, but they're getting rid of the plastic bags due to a law that Adolf Inslee instituted, I think in like April or May, that is now going to be coming into effect in January, that's going to ban plastic bags. Now, it's, of course, it's vague and it's open to interpretation, but it does say that, you know, you're exempt if temperature or dampness is a concern. So maybe you can still use plastic bags for freezable items or hot takeout like we are doing. So we might not be affected by this, as if I give a shit anyway. But I mean, we can't go to paper. If we were to go to paper, we're supposed to sell them for like 8 cents a piece or 12 cents a piece or something. We wouldn't do that. We just give it to you in paper. But, and then the paper is supposed to be 40% recyclable. We're just turning into California, we're like taking all the cues from California. So I guess there's going to be a straw ban here next year or some bullshit. It's like they take all the worst ideas from California and go, man, that's a really terrible idea. That's really fucking retarded. Now hold my beer while we do the same thing or make it even worse. So Idaho is looking more and more attractive. Any of the states to the east until you get to the East Coast are looking better than this nightmare. I can't see it getting any better anytime soon. It's just bad. It's just bad news. And I'm sure that our $2 wager on sporting goods bets is probably illegal too. So, you know, I'm just going to get rounded up one of these days.
Well, Robert, our alleged bet, and it was just satirical betting. I mean, no money has actually exchanged hands. It's all just conjecture, and it's all in good fun. We're not actually betting. It's not a gambling establishment. We don't have nor require a license for it. Now, before we get into the Last Star Sports Show, introduce our guests, I do want to just comment. In California, I think when they did ban all those single-use items, then this COVID thing happened, and then they brought them all back. So it's like this really bizarre thing, right? Because they're like trying to save the earth, and now they're like, nah, fuck the earth.
Some of the criticism from today's or the new ban here is, oh, but what about COVID? You're going to use single or, you know, repeated use reusable bags. Then they're just going to get COVID in there, and then everybody's going to die from COVID. Whereas these single use, because everywhere else we're supposed to use single use. Like, we were banned from using plastic menus unless you are to spray it down in between and wipe it down in between each time someone touches it. So you have to use single use paper menus to each person. But it's like, yeah, their own dumbass policies are interfering with their other dumbass policies, which is, well, it's just real stupid. I don't know what to say.
It's Dumas. If you
but anyway, no, please. Daniel, we're betting in World of Warcraft, so it's okay. $2 in World of Warcraft, it'll be fine.
All right, yeah, that's good enough. Now, I was going to say one more thing. Oh, so apparently, and this is in the Tom Woods email he sent out today, with all this cleaning that's going on of all these surfaces, there's actually no verified instance of transmission on a surface. So all of this cleaning is just theater. I think there was an op-ed in the Washington Post that he was referencing, saying that all of this is for naught. It's just this huge vestigial thing that appears to be doing something, but it's actually not effective at all. And this layperson has heard in the past that we were, as a society, Western society, causing all sorts of problems by using antibacterial soap, and all these super bacterias were becoming resistant to these things. And so it makes sense to me that we might be overcleaning, overdoing it, and thus creating more harm in the near future as a result of overcleaning. Also, I believe as a child and, you know, just as a human, your immune system needs to be exposed to different things to build up immunity and tolerance for such things. So if you're in a sterile environment, what happens when you then are no longer able to be in a sterile environment? I think that's going to make you worse off than had you been rooting around in the mud, skinning your knee, rubbing dirt in it, and whatever. You know, just it's like country bumpkin fucking logic. And I think it actually carries a little bit of water.
Human beings throughout their entire history, since there have been human beings, have been living cheek to jowl with bacteria and viruses. Viruses and bacteria were here long before us. They'll be here long after us. And human beings have evolved alongside them, coexisted for many tens of thousands of years, if not millions of years. And to think that all of a sudden today in 2020, we have to get rid of these things. No, you don't. You have an immune system. Be well, be good to it. Get your vitamins and your minerals, get plenty of rest, get plenty of liquids. If you get sick, you can like stay home. Otherwise, live your life. This is stupid.
All right. So living healthy is better than a crusade against a virus or a multitude of viruses. And let's get into our crusade episode tonight as we introduce Mike C in the Last Nighters portion of the show. Hey everyone, it's Daniel Elwood and Two Baller Bill, formerly known as Robert Paul Johnson, and we are the Last Nighters. You can find us on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. I will find the link for that and put it on our show notes page at lastnighters.com/155. And we're here to spread a little Christmas cheer. And we bring our friend Mike Z from up north as we review the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven, because nothing says Christmas like a movie where Legolas saves the people of Jerusalem in the Battle of Helm's Deep 2. So welcome, Mike. How are things going with you, and how are things up in Canada?
Oh, Canada. Yeah, it's not so bad. I'm emotionally threadbare, pretty excitable these days. But for the most part, just kind of focusing on my propaganda and not getting in fights with strangers. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like we're supposed to fight with each other a lot. And that's sort of been a long game of the state. But I don't know. I'm pretty calm. A lot calmer than a lot of people I talk to, I guess, in answer to your question.
Well, that's good. That's good. And you've been, in the pre-show, we were talking about some of the things you've been working on, stressing yourself out, perhaps. And you are working on a new album under your Mechanical Dream Revolution musical venture. And you might have a Christmas gift that you can share with our audience. And that is one of your new tracks from the album. Is that an accurate statement?
Yes, yes. I sent you the link. It's all mastered and ready to go. It's episode 5 of a 13-episode season. These episodes, as I call them, are sets of like an hour-long music, sometimes more, generally. So, yeah, I mean, that's it. That's my gift to you. It's also my gift to me to promote my shit. So I don't make money off it or anything. People tell me I should set up like a Patreon or some stuff. But I've been just kind of focusing on trying to get a message that I believe in out. Before any kind of popularity, I guess, because I feel like they tend to run interference on stuff that if you use copyrighted material and things like that, they've got a lot of tricks up their sleeves. So I've just kind of been focusing on this particular thing. So, I mean, it's kind of you guys are kind of on board with a man focusing on a task, trying to get the fruit afterwards.
Yeah, we've talked about that a time or two. Now, is the album art behind you, that is the song that you've released or are releasing?
Yeah, that's The Last Jedi. That's the Last Starfighter. So I don't know. You can kind of see part of it. I can actually send you the picture if you want to post that as well.
Okay, we will.
So does it include clips from the classic film? Or is this just some of the...
I don't actually include The Last Starfighter in that at all. Kind of a dick move, really. But... there's a lot of stuff about Star Wars and my love of Star Wars. So I don't really touch Star Wars at all in my music. I just kind of did this one time. I did one piece a while ago, like in 2014, maybe. I might have been right after. No, it wouldn't have been after Last Jedi. Anyway, so I did this piece, and it's got a lot of stuff about sort of cowboys and Star Wars and just narrative. And I don't know. You kind of have to listen to it. I don't know. Dan tried to describe it a couple of times, and it doesn't really work. Pretty much just send somebody a link and say, listen to this for 10 minutes, and if you like it, keep listening.
Yeah, because it goes for another hour and a half.
Yeah, but it's good. I think it's very good. Like, this is, people keep telling me this is my best sort of work, you know, and it's 15 hours of shit to listen to if you want to. It covers the medium of exchange and the medium of expression being controlled by sort of conglomerated power structures. You know, our currency is controlled, our means of talking to each other is controlled, our narrative is curated and put towards, you know, certain things. They tend to destroy our stories or make us pay for them while destroying them. I cover a lot of, you know, just sort of the full spectrum of what's going on now, the Marxist infiltration in the 30s. Stuff like that. Frankfurt, bit of Jesus School. Christ in there in the end too, as a as an extension of Platonistic thinking and the foundational philosophies of Western culture and what is essentially the center of liberty for the planet, right?
Like, right. We sort of came up with this. Robert. It's good driving music. So if you come back and visit, you can give it a listen. But we'll have that on the show notes page, lastnarratives.com/155. And you can get our pre-show and post-show bonus content at lastnarratives.com/Patreon. And let's kick this off with the old Google description, which is how we start these off. So Kingdom of Heaven came out in, says here, 2005. It's a war/adventure film. The director's cut is 3 hours and 14 minutes. Got 7.2 out of 10 on IMDb, 39% Rotten Tomatoes, 63% Metacritic. However, 90% of Google users like it. The description reads, still in grief over his wife's sudden death, village blacksmith Balian, played by Orlando Bloom, joins his long-estranged father, Baron Godfrey, Liam Neeson, as a crusader on the road to Jerusalem. After a perilous journey to the Holy City, the valiant young man enters the retinue of the leprous King Baldwin IV, played by Edward Norton, which is rife with dissent led by the treacherous Guy de Lusignan, Martin Socas, who wishes to wage war against the Muslims for his own political and personal gain. Release date, May 6, 2005. Directors Ridley Scott, budget $135 million, and worldwide box office of $218.1 million. And they butchered this thing when it went out to theaters. They cut it about 45 minutes or so. So around Christmas that year, 2005, I believe that's when the director's cut version came out. And there's even a Village Roadshow version that has a musical interlude to open, like an overture to open it, and then an intermission with another little musical, like 1 minute orchestration before you get into the second half of the film. So, Robert, let's get your take on the director's cut of Kingdom of Heaven by the great Ridley Scott.
So, from the man that brought us Gladiator, brings us another historical epic. I guess you would have to compare the two. And for my money, Gladiator still wins it, simply because the revenge story is actually very palpable in Gladiator. In this movie, the main character is just sort of seeking redemption, seeking to gain a connection to God. We're not exactly sure what he wants and what it would look like if he got what he wanted. Let's put it that way. Like, is he staring at a sunset? Is he having a vision? Is he gonna, I don't know, see a child smile and then he's fulfilled? It's not clear from a plot point, you know, from an audience perspective. Like in Gladiator, you knew Russell Crowe needed to have some kind of revenge against Rome, right? Against Caesar. But in this movie, his wife's dead from suicide. And what, he's got to just find a new life. So from my perspective, I didn't really latch onto his story as much. Like, I wasn't like behind him, like, yeah, man, you go to Jerusalem and you do the whatever thing that you think you need to do, whatever that is. I mean, it's just not clear. So you can't really, from an audience perspective, you can't really just like get behind him and like, yeah, I'm with this guy. I guess you could, but his motivation didn't engage me. Now, I will say, though, that this movie is very entertaining, and it's helped along by some really gorgeous scenery, and the acting was quite good with a very talented cast. One of my favorite things was having watched Game of Thrones Season 8, where they fucked the dog on tactics, especially in the Battle of Winterfell, but pretty much the entire season was just shithouse garbage. For any kind of tactical consideration, where anybody was even thinking in the slightest bit about how two giant armies would face each other with even like one brain cell on either side, like what would we do? Where would we put our cavalry? Where would we put our artillery? Where, you know, what kind of skirmishes would we launch? What's our strategy for scaling walls? How would you defend against people scaling walls? And all these kinds of things that are super well thought out. Like, there's hundreds of thousands of years of medieval siege warfare to draw upon. So people in this time really had it pretty much figured out. Like, the movie kind of gives the blacksmith like this kind of new idea-y kind of guy, but it's not really clear that he's like this new engineer-y dude. Like, it's not really presented that way. He's a blacksmith and he's got some ideas, but it's not like, hey, I'm a genius siege defender guy and we're going to build this thing that's going to protect us against whatever is being thrown against us. But they end up do doing some of that, and I was all for it. I was all engaged in, okay, you're against an overwhelming force. What are you going to do? You have the defensive position, and there is some talk about, you know, fighting away from water, which I really appreciated as a fan of Sun Tzu and the Art of War. Considering where you fight and getting your opponent to fight on your terms is super duper duper important. And my big issue with the movie, aside from what I've said so far, is just the cartoonness of the main villain characters. They seem to have very little motivation other than I'm evil and I want power. And it doesn't, they're what they did power to get power to maintain power didn't make sense to me. Like, I'm going to go poke the tail of the dragon and inspire this massive army to attack me because I just want to have a fight. I want to be in an army. You're going to go out there and you're going to get slaughtered by an overwhelming superior force. It didn't make sense to me what the villain's plans were or what they wanted and how the plot, what they did within the story to get those ends. Like at one point, the commander of the army turns into the king, but his first act is to be like, all right, let's go fight and get slaughtered out in the desert. What were you trying to do? What were you trying to achieve? What did you want? I didn't, none of that made sense to me, but I did like Orlando Bloom as an actor. I like the overall story for the most part. I like that he was more concerned about the people. I don't know if it necessarily rang true in terms of like inspiring people. Like usually they point to something outside of themselves, something beyond themselves to inspire people. But he was very much, no, we're doing this for all these people. This is what I give a shit about. I don't care about some cause, some ethereal God being, you know, all this stuff. I care about these living, breathing people, which from my perspective as a voluntarist, you know, humanist type person, I very much appreciated. So that's a whole lot. I just spewed a whole bunch. I don't know where you guys want to take it from there, but I'm sure you probably had things to say in the middle of that or anywhere. And now who knows what you're going to say, but that's my initial take on this film. Very, very good, but not perfect.
All right. Yeah, there was a lot to talk about, and I had muted myself to prevent myself from butting in because I noticed that I do that occasionally. but yeah, I think a lot of what you're saying makes sense. It is a beautiful film. I think that it has some pretty, a lot of moving parts, and a lot of those moving parts have gotten removed from the theatrical version. And with Ridley Scott putting them back in, a lot of it makes more sense than how audiences might have viewed this in theaters. The whole element of the son of the Princess of Jerusalem or Queen of Jerusalem, the what's her name? Eva Green. Sybil? Is that her name?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so in the theatrical cut, the kid's not even in it at all. But in this one, you know, there's a big motivator because he was the heir to Baldwin, Edward Norton's character. And he had the same affliction. And so she was motivated by that to basically shield him from the misery that she knew was coming. I guess Baldwin, he seemed pretty wise for his years, but he died at the age of like 23 or 24 of the leprosy. And I mean, that's pretty amazing that somebody of that age, now granted, we've talked about this in the past, Robert, where...
No, wait a minute. He died at 23, 24 in real life or in this movie? Because in this movie, he seemed like he was like a 30.
He said he wouldn't live to see 30.
Right, so he was like 28, 29.
Well, how old was Alexander when he almost conquered the known world?
Alexander was like 23, 24, yeah.
Yeah, so this is just the thing is we're all a bunch of pussies now, basically. Yeah. We just become fat, lazy assholes, and do nothing with our lives. These guys are fucking the whole world.
But Baldwin did die.
He's a pussy waiting to get fucked. What?
He did die in real life at age 23 or 24, something like that. Okay.
As long as it's a prime number, I'm happy. Okay, I don't know. Like you, okay? Did you see the theatrical release?
I did not see the theatrical, but I did see Ridley Scott's opening to it, and he said that he highlighted some scenes that he or some plot lines that he brought back in.
Yeah, well, we can all
They massacred the movie by removing these very
they're essential. I mean, you can cut it the way you can cut Fortinbras from Hamlet if you want to, you know what I mean? But it's like, it's preposterous, really. I mean, and I think at that point Ridley Scott had earned the right to succeed or fail on his own merit. I didn't think the studio should be fucking with him at that point. You know, like after the sort of comeback of Blade Runner over the years, and then Gladiator, and then I mean, think after this one he did he had already done Black Hawk Down as well, right? If you're into some, you know, war hawking and stuff, but
yeah.
In answer to your question about the motivations of the bad guys, they're warmongers, and they're not really offering any, like they liked killing. They could, you know, and there are people that like that. But I think the whole idea is about good leadership and bad leadership and totalitarianist leadership and the leadership of like the spiritual. So like I wrote down leadership is spiritual, not total, is kind of the thesis of the film, is what I got out of it, and how that correlates to the difference between religious structure and God, sort of the path of Christ and the philosophy of Christ versus what the church does with it, right? Stuff like that, and rules and how rules exist, but really they're only defended by people with swords. So it's really just about the decisions that men with swords make in given situations, right? And they said it over and over. Like he's talking about like your actions in the moment. Like, you know, Edward Norton sits him down and says, like, when you're up there facing judgment, like you won't be able to say, oh, I didn't know, or somebody told me to do it this way and I just wasn't sure. You know, like your decisions are yours. So I do enjoy that sort of tone, the themes in the film. I don't know.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts was that initial scene. And I even wrote down some quotes. He basically says, holiness is in right action.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And when you stand before God, you cannot say, but I was told to, or virtue was inconvenient. Yeah. I really did appreciate that. And that was set a good, you know, that I like that Orlando Bloom was this knight that was actually trying to be a good knight.
Yeah, and so that was kind of his journey, is just sort of being called upon by some divine force, some narrative force that put him in a situation where he ended up having to lead people. And in that position of power, what did he do with the power? He chose to cultivate the land, and he chose to protect the people, the peasants, and to elevate everyone to the status of nobility as much as he could, which is interesting given like the consensus with the elite historically to abuse power, you know? So it's kind of about that struggle. Is like
Now there was Scylla at one point. She was like, yeah, the rules, those are for the other people, not for us.
Yeah, she says that once. And then in the end, she shows her true colors and says, like, what is it? When this is over, there will come a time when you wish you will have done a little evil to do a greater good. And then I think the greater good from...
Yeah, exactly. And then that was like the temptation of Christ, right? Like, and he was like,
no, totally. And that's, I like my man, Mr. Scott, for that kind of stuff, right? It is a kingdom of conscience or nothing. That's not a bad line either. So these sort of hard lines of like governance is only allowable by way of altruism, like of the person having, because we're not talking about like, we didn't have electricity and guns and things like that to protect ourselves. So we needed some sort of structure. And so basically it says that the more power you have, the more you're obligated to have a higher standard, which is again the concept of chivalry, right?
The knight's code, right? Something like that.
Yeah, it was codified over so many years, right? But that's all based on this idea that, like, you know, forgiveness is divine and creating the best situation for people and having rules that apply to everybody and not just some people, you know, of content. Yeah.
Now, if we get into some of the motivations of the characters themselves or just the motivations within the time and the events that were occurring, the Pope had called for a crusade to reclaim the Holy Land by claiming that we needed to go take it and that killing the infidels was not murder. And it would be your path to absolution of your sins. And if you die in that battle, then you end up in the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah.
I think that's where the title comes from. So in essence, they're dehumanizing the enemy and they believe that they are on a mission from God, like Blues Brothers style, that they can't fail. And I think that's where the cartoonish villains, they're Knights Templar, right? They are
the Knights Templar are basically James Bond villain, or they're basically Spectre at that point, right?
Right, right. And they're like religious zealots. Like they're so, they believe so wholeheartedly in this divine thing that they're doing, even though it's a great evil that they're doing, but they're convinced. They've convinced themselves that they're doing a great thing. Robert, we've talked about this many times. Many people who commit horrific acts say they're doing it for the good of the people, or the, you know, they have to justify to their own selves to be able to go through with what they're doing, even if it is a great, great evil. So I kind of buy into them being cartoonish villains and even trying to poke the bear and pick a fight with the Muslims, because they had defeated them 80 or 90 years previously and had held them off for that period of time. They thought that they had some divine power that was not going to allow them to lose. And so that's why they got cocky and disregarded the tactical advice that you were talking about earlier. You know, bring the enemy to you or to where you want to fight them. Make sure that you have your supply lines and your water and all those things that you need. They just threw all that caution in the wind. And the cross that they were carrying around, I guess, in the real Crusades, in this real battle of, was it called Hattusa? Like that plateau where they marched out to fight Saladin and ended up getting slaughtered. They had a piece of the actual cross that Jesus Christ was crucified on, and they were treating it Indiana Jones Nazi style, as if this divine object had some superpower that was going to prevent them from losing no matter what they did. So it's almost like, you know, as cars have gotten more and more safety devices in them, the occupants feel like they're at less risk of injury. And so as much as you keep the occupants more safe, it causes people to drive more recklessly. And so people outside the cars, like pedestrians and whatnot, are at greater risk. I think I've seen numbers on that. So like the safer you feel driving, the less careful you will be to drive. Similar to if you think you have not only this mission from God, but then this divine artifact with you that will not permit you to lose, then you're going to be a lot less careful about the decisions you make.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I guess they could also count on the presence of the piece of the cross to inspire, right? Like,
well,
everything you said would also create that kind of motivation in that, like you said, the right feeling that there wouldn't be like morale issues, right? And a lot of times in medieval battles, it was fairly even space. Like there's only most of all the fighting happens along on the front, right? Where the two armies are colliding. And so you really only have a small portions of the army that are actually engaged in lethal combat. I mean, you've got some archers back and forth, but you got shields to kind of negate that. You might take some casualties, but the real main killing is right at the front, and everybody else behind is like, well, we're okay. And then you can kind of cycle guys back and forth, and you can actually fight for like hours and hours. And these medieval battles would just go on and on and on,
okay,
and not really, you know, doing the killing the death blow. Until one of the other army, their morale broke. And they were like, fuck this shit, we're out. And then they turned tail and ran. And then the slaughter begins. And so I could see the value in having this relic along with you, inspiring everybody like, no, we can't lose. No matter how bad it looks, guys, we're going to win this. So don't even worry about it. I would probably, if I was a religious army of the Christians back in those days, I'd carry that shit with me all the time.
Yeah, trust the plan.
I'd also worry about water and, you know, supply lines, but I would still have those relics to kind of inspire everybody, because you do not want to suffer a morale defeat. That is when you lose big time.
Right. And then,
no,
and
that's two again, right?
Go ahead, Mike. I was going to take
Okay. Well, you can't, I mean, you were talking about Sun Tzu, right? You can't, like, one of the, I can't remember what they're called. There's some, you know, like, the different, I don't know, the pages or something at the beginning, it has a list. And, you know, one of the things is morale. Like, if you don't have the people behind a war, you need to, like, fly a building into, or a plane into a building or something to get everybody on board with the war, or have Pearl Harbor, Gulf of Tonkin, right? That's a really great example. No one would dispute that one. You got to get the people behind it. And then on top of that, the microcosm of that is, like Rob said, the battle itself, right? And you things get broken over time. What's interesting about this, though, is that, yeah, both sides have artifacts, these magical narratives that are, you know, imbued upon into artifacts. So you got the Spear of Destiny and the cross and all these things. And that comes out of symbols as well, right? We have flags and banners and standards, which is funny. I love the word standard because it is the masthead of an army, but it also now contemporarily means like the manner in which you hold yourself to. I thought that was interesting over time, right? But basically, this movie is interesting to me because it has a very stark contrast between the church, the Pope, the motivations of like essentially what are governments motivating or, you know, inscripting people through poverty and whatnot and indoctrination to go wage war for them just for economic reasons, solely for economic reasons. And then the other motivation of leadership, which is spiritual and defensive and protecting. And it's interesting that like, cause like, yeah, the army, like those idiots, they go out and they get themselves slaughtered because they think that they're untouchable. Maybe the Pope blessed them or whatever. And what's interesting is that Orlando Bloom uses the exact same tactic or the exact same sort of rhetorical trick of saying like, no, you're knights. You're all knights now. You're going to fight better. And what's interesting is like good wins over evil in this, essentially, in terms of like a lot of the evil people are punished in this and a lot of the good people are spared and succeed at their task. And it's by right action. And it's like, you know, does making a man a knight make him a better fighter? And he just like definitively says, yes, it does, because that man has something to believe in and he has faith behind him. Now, I won't debate whether or not that faith is warranted. I'm just saying that like when somebody is clear of mind, they are much better at succeeding at tasks that are before them.
Yeah, they have purpose.
Those doubts don't come creeping into their brain in the middle when things get bad.
Yeah. The reason the bad guys, their artifacts don't work when the Nazis get the Ark of the Covenant, it doesn't work because there's an evil intention behind it. And I think that at some inherent level or some base level that we understand when somebody is lying to us, at least to an extent, like we're like, well, I don't know. It's just a piece of the cross ultimately. Right. Like I'll follow you, but this guy is a fucking idiot and we don't have any water. And, you know, like, and how can you internally justify the motivation of a forced march versus the motivation of a defensive position? You know, like one, you can understand one and not the other, like as an animal. Like you don't really need to be an intellectual to understand that like defending yourself is justified and attacking somebody is not always justified. That's my closing statement.
Okay. Right.
So
yeah, like
that's why the bad guys don't their magic doesn't work because it's bad.
Right. Like I didn't really understand like how they were inspiring their soldiers other than this crusading holy war. Money, but like, was there really a lot of plunder to be had when you're facing this massive force? Like I don't know. Like plundering trade routes, like was what they were doing before.
Isn't the Muslim jihad thing like 72 virgins? Like if you die, you know, doing jihad.
During a holy war, yeah.
That's the layman, right? That's the peasant's version of God, you know? It's like, up and there'll be like fucking chocolate fountains and you'll get lots of pussy, like, I guess. I mean, that motivates a child, right? But I mean, I think as you get older, that's like most men sort of grow past that. So like you pretty much got to get a guy that, you know, doesn't have a dad and put him in school, Muslim school or whatever maybe it's not pick on the Muslims, but because you get like indoctrinated people. I mean, the army recruitment center is like just outside of high schools and shit, right? Like outside of malls and stuff, right? It's all poverty.
15-year-olds, people whose brains have not developed.
Yeah.
I don't know. Take it right now, right? I mean, I see a divergence of like two possible sort of alternate realities happening right now, where one is people waking up and wanting freedom and the other is people that will be slaves. And I honestly, like, it's to the point where I think about it in terms of like parallel universes, because like it honestly seems like some people want to follow and be slaves and other people want to follow with a sense of conscience. And I mean, that's why I like this movie so much, is because it talks a lot about what leadership is, you know, in a way that isn't too preachy. It has a lot of depth of character, you know?
Yeah. Now I do like, a lot of what you're saying, and I've had like 10 things I've wanted to say, but then we keep.
Okay. Here, I'm going to mute my mic right now.
Talk over each other. that's fine. That's what we do here. But what the hell was I going to say? So back to the motivations, and you were just talking about it a little bit here, where I was bringing up the modern day concept of the jihad and the 72 versions, but they're basically doing the same thing on the Christian side back in the Crusades per this movie. And that is one of the things that got Orlando Bloom interested in going at all, was that he had strong beliefs in that his sins and his wife committing suicide being a sin would mean that she was burning in hell. And so he believed that by going to Jerusalem, he was going to absolve not only himself of those sins, but also his wife and save her from hell. So it's one of those like recruitment tools, motivating factors for useful idiots to be pawns into the games of kings and other men playing at a grander scale, the grand chessboard, if you will. And I think Ed Norton's character even mentioned it. Like, will you be a pawn of another man or at the whimsy of a king?
Well, so how better to get recruitment than to say you're all sinners and then go, but here's a path to absolve those sins.
Yeah. And also like you're fucking eating maggot filled bread.
Problem reaction solution right here, baby.
And we'll give you a chicken to eat. What better story is there than a guy that's lost and then joins essentially the army trying to find absolution in horseshit? And then realizes that that's horseshit, but still gets through that and becomes a great leader. Like, he's essentially the king by the end. So he goes from peasant to king. And through that journey is all of the propaganda. And he just keeps going like, oh, okay. Well, now I can see firsthand. And then the core of his being, the righteous, heroic dude that was inside, like, kept making the right decisions. And making the right decisions each time exalted him. Which I think is a pretty epic story, right?
So I think that's what you like about it. He's navigating the narrative by staying true to his principles, and he gets past all the propaganda.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah.
Liam Neeson, so much fucking killing.
Liam Neeson gives him some good fatherly advice, which he does at the end of his life. He wasn't there for at all for the rest of his life, or his early beginning, but whatever.
He did apologize.
He was like, sorry about that, my bad. And then Orlando Bloom's like, thanks, Dad. And then he's like, Mr. I can be great knight guy. What did you guys think of the Christian bishop guy who's like this weaselly guy who was like, we'll convert to Islam and then we'll ask forgiveness later? And he was just like this super weaselly Christian leader guy.
Super
who Orlando Bloom could like easily see through that this guy's like a piece of shit. Was he a little bit too comic booky for you guys, or did he seem kind of?
I don't know. I mean, that's kind of how bishops are, aren't they? I mean, they fuck it sometimes. So like,
yeah, no, that's true.
Okay, I just do not like the structure of the church. And before we're done this thing, let's surely get into the Templars at some point too, right? Because like, they are comic book villains. But yeah, I mean, it was a bit. It's a movie though, right? Like, it's a little over the top. I wouldn't even say it's over the top. It's like he's just a dick. You've met people that are like that though. And you can kind of tell, talk to somebody for a bit. You're like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure when the chips are down, you would fucking sell me out for an extra food ration. So I'm not going to give you any more information about my lifestyle. Thanks. Like,
but this is a guy like this bishop dude, whose job, who's in the market of selling religion, right? Like he's got to not only like talk about how great it is, but like live it. And then he's basically turning like saying, no, it's a bunch of bullshit. Don't worry about it. And like at the drop of a hat, it seems like he's out of a job after this movie. Wouldn't you think?
No, not at all. They Trump's not going to be out of a job. You can go TV shit or something.
To a different parish and then he'll be fine.
Nixon's doing okay. I'm sure. Is he dead yet? Anyways, like Obama's doing fine. Hillary's not in jail. She lost. And the whole movie is about this sort of leadership of the spirit versus totalitarianism of rules. You know, like all these, you're supposed to do this. You got to cut your wife's head off because she killed herself. It's like, well, I don't know. I don't think Jesus said that. I've read the Gospels and he doesn't say that once. Cut your girlfriend's head off if she kills herself. You know, he didn't even say not to like fuck before marriage, you know, like it's like no. So again, this is like the philosophy of what is essentially an extension of Platonistic thinking, you know, sort of a, I don't want to get into the debate. I might offend somebody on how I view Christianity, but I do very much enjoy the philosophy of Christ. Like the fundamental, the universal ethic of it is the foundation, I think, of liberty and free market systems.
So Mike, as our resident expert on Christianity, what is the reasoning behind having suicide be this great sin?
Well, I mean, you're giving up God's greatest gift, I guess, I think is the rhetoric. But again, it's like, I mean, a lot of that I think is purely economical. Like you need to motivate people to continue to work. You can't have them giving up on things. You can't have them not having a bunch of kids. You know, you need them to be obedient, good consumers and workers, right? And so this is the abuse of this philosophy by, you know, probably at first the Roman state, and then as other states adopted this sort of, I wouldn't say paradigm, maybe a paradigm, but like just basically like the religion, you know, it formed it into a religion, which is essentially just another form of government, right? Telling somebody how the relationship with God should be is just, you know, and then they tax you for it, right? Like that just seems to be like government 1.0, right? And the government is the religion 2.0. So this movie talks a lot about how, like, you know, the Pope is essentially just making up rules and the rules are coming down, and it doesn't matter like what the justification is. The justification is the authority of the state. It's a means of getting people to behave a certain way. And I don't know, sometimes that's a, you know, maybe justifiable, and like a speed limit, stoplights, stuff like that, right? But when you start getting into like, you know, you need to run your life this way, I can fuck your wife, you know, because I'm a lord, stuff like that, you know, I'm, you know, you kind of start going against the grain of what I think, at least what I read, from the teachings of Jesus. So
he's just talking about the divine right of kings, doesn't he? He's always talking about banging.
He doesn't talk about fucking, doesn't talk about mutilating dead bodies. Hmm. He said, you live by the sword, you die by the sword, you know, turn the other cheek, you know, which is the problem. The only problem I see with Christianity is it can't really defend itself, because it can be, that can be exploited, right? If you're willing to walk into a cafe with a bomb strapped to your chest, it's very difficult to turn the other cheek. You'll start losing that fight over time. So you need a crusade. And that's how we end up with this conflict, right? And I'm not talking about, maybe I shouldn't muddle that. I'm going to sort of sound like a bit of hate speech, but I actually have no hate for Muslims at all. I have no particular love for that nation, but I do like the idea of like philosophically, like Christendom and Islam and like even Buddhism, trying to create a standard of behavior that is not enforceable, that is not enforced by anything but shame and that kind of pressure. Because I feel like that's a better solution than armed forces. That kind of went in circles there a bit there. But I did get myself out of the situation, so.
Good enough. Well, I just wanted to bring up, we're talking about the bishop a little bit ago, and he's a very pragmatic person who, you're right, is one of the first who would sell out. Yeah. Because he probably didn't really believe in his ideas, and he's a great contrast to the Orlando Bloom's character, who is guided by principle and not pragmatism. Now, I think that's like a minor relationship that we see in the movie, but I think that's kind of the point of that being brought up, because I'm sure he saw, the bishop knew the history of Jerusalem, and when the Christians took it 100 years prior, they killed everybody. And so he knew that that was what was likely to happen if they were not going to be able to keep the Muslims out were, you know, sieging the wall. So he was like, well, it's death or be Weasley.
Yeah. And he said, you get on a fast horse and get out of a lesser gate. And he's like, well, what about all these people, you asshole? And he's like, oh, I don't know.
He's a bishop.
God will it. God will it.
What's he got to be afraid of?
Yeah. Right. Or he doesn't.
He's led a righteous life. And that's my point. It's like, so these like, it's when you start getting into rules and laws and things like that. And it's like, even at the beginning of the movie where they come to get him for murder. Right. And it's like, okay, that's righteous. But I mean, who's enforcing it and how are you going to enforce it? And what does that even mean? Like, what kind of trial would you have? Like, why would I give myself up to you? And then you get into the prisoner's dilemma, right? Where if And I would go further, like, whether you're guilty or not, you have every right to try to get out of prison, killing anybody in your path. Like, you know, like, until they put you in the ground, you're a human being that wants to live. So, like, the idea that you would be motivated to, like, lay down and die over that. So what's interesting about this is you get this sort of, like, nice balance in the film about turning the other cheek and having a righteous path and, like, doing the right thing, but not just giving up or letting people, like, fist you, you know?
Yeah. Like, Orlando Bloom's character at the beginning was he was turning the other cheek for a long time with that priest guy who was prodding him. And in the theatrical cut, it's not revealed that he's his brother or half brother, but in the director's cut, it is. So there's even more of a, dynamic to the relationship.
Cain and Abel vibe of some kind.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And also, you know, there's like some history there. And, you know, he had cut off the wife's head after she was dead and then started talking shit about her and had stolen her necklace. And that was what pushed Orlando Bloom's character over the edge. But up until that point, he was turning the other cheek. He was not responding to the provocations of that half brother who was trying to pick a fight with him, you know, flick his nose, punch him in the face. The John Lennon quote, you know, once you get, they get you violent, they know how to deal with you. But if you don't do that, then they're not sure what to do. So that's kind of what I was reading into that. Like Orlando Bloom, even without being a developed character just yet in the film, he already was displaying those principles, but he also showed that there was a line beyond which once pushed, he would respond to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what did you think of that? What did you think that killing was justified, Daniel? Do you think he was a murderer?
I think he was a murderer. I mean, I'd have to rewatch the scene again, but it sure seemed like he didn't necessarily need to stab him with a hot sword and throw him into a fire for his stealing his wife's necklace.
Well, he's grave robbing, though.
Cutting her dead head
off. That is a motivator. I mean, Buddy was on the edge, and he was trying to get him to fight back. He kept, you know, smacking around, saying like, "You need to defend yourself." And so that's another sort of like, I love how the beginning of this movie and the end of this movie bookend the journey. Like there's a lot of symmetry, right? Where he knights him, gives him the lines. He says the lines to all the people at the end. A lot of like in watching this sort of the fourth time or whatever, you know, I'm really paying attention to the dialogue between those two. And he's saying all sorts of stuff that comes up later on, right?
You talking about him and Godfrey?
No, him and his brother.
Oh, okay. I feel like this is a movie that if you watch it a few times, you get much more out of it.
Yeah, no, I can't believe you haven't seen this one. Like this kind of came out when you probably had disposable income and enough time to watch a 3-hour movie. So it's kind of weird you didn't see this one.
No, this was panned. This piece of shit was panned by everybody and people avoided it like the plague.
I just looked it up. It's 20th Century Fox. And I love Fox because they'll print anything, but you don't have any control over it. So they made like Space Above and Beyond and they made Firefly and they gave The Simpsons a shot and you know, like they'll do anything, but then they control it and they chop it up and they fuck with it and they put spin on it. They'll print any news article too. Like, so the CNN just omits shit and Fox just prints things and spins the hell out of it. It's kind of interesting that they're different kind of approaches to the machine. But yeah, no, I am. They're on the list now for sure. After cutting this down 45 minutes, that's a grave sin. I think they should have their heads cut off in Minecraft.
Yeah, I think
mine's spelled M-E-I-N.
They'll have to go to Jerusalem, fight a holy war.
I think the Ridley Scott interview, he was saying that, you know, they cut the hell out of this because of the test screenings or focus groups or whatever. And he was like, you know, maybe that's an okay thing to do for like an unproven director, but once you've kind of, you know, earned your stripes.
Yeah. He didn't negotiate properly.
Yeah. Then you, you know, shouldn't have to be subjected to that.
Kubrick negotiated himself into an early grave by having Final Cut on Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah. Yeah. Once you're a established director, you can negotiate. For Final Cut, you don't take as big.
Would have to kill you to cut 14 minutes out of your final film if they wanted to change it.
Yeah. I mean, you pay for that.
Note to self, don't make a movie about the elite pedophiles that run the world.
Are you saying there could be some negative consequences, Mike?
Yeah. I don't know. He's probably in heaven if there is one. I'm not really sure I even agree to that, but I do agree on righteous behavior, and this is all we have, so we might as well act as though we have autonomy, agency, and there is ultimately a choice that you can feel as soon as you make it. But too heavy?
No, that's right on line with this movie. You are
Let's
the
talk about it next.
So, Robert, I want to go to you because you usually have opinions on such things as the acting. You've already said that you found the acting to be good in this film. Did you buy Orlando Bloom as a warrior lead actor? I couldn't really. He felt like a little empty there. Like he wasn't quite leading man material for me. Like I just kept seeing Legolas, and he's fine.
Yeah. Shame.
No. Daniel's right. Daniel's right. He's Orlando. There's a reason why Orlando Bloom is not the leading man, macho dude. He's a little bit too much beta. He just doesn't have the body mass and the charisma to be that leading man guy. I mean, yeah, sure, he's good looking enough, but he's more like some kind of runway model type looking dude, like thin and, you know.
I heard he gained 20 pounds for this role.
He was stacked.
Yeah, he had to. I mean, he had a little bit of upper body muscle, but he just doesn't have that alpha.
Long swords are heavy. Long swords are very heavy. If you've ever held one, they're not like, I'm like, okay, I can do this for 20 minutes in a controlled environment, but I'm not fucking doing this for real ever. They did pretty well with the choreography. They could have done better to make it more sort of technically driven, where he's overcoming the brute force with, you know, the way of the intercepting fist. So I think they did well to illustrate that. And then they did a very good job, or he did a very good job, Ridley Scott, I mean, talking or visually describing his other skill set. So they showed him fighting, but they only showed him fighting sometimes. A lot of the time he was, you know, like motivating and running things, and he was an engineer and stuff. So
planning things, yeah.
I buy his size. I mean, yeah, he could be probably 6 inches taller and maybe a bit wider, but you know, I can believe it, maybe because I'm not huge and I want to believe it, but I totally see what you're saying. They could have done better with the choreography where he just kind of like is a bit more spinny and moving.
Yeah, he could have been a little more acrobatic-y, and then you would have bought that his agility was making up for his lack of size.
Like if he slid down the stairs while firing an arrow at rapid fire and taking out jihadists.
Yeah, I just don't buy that this, you know, 170-pound guy is going to be able to swing this broadsword and not just get his shit mixed by some 250-pound guy who just meets his sword in the middle. And he's just going to, anyway.
Yeah, and it's not even like I was watching this thinking he's small. I didn't think that. It's just he didn't have that, I don't know, that intangible je ne sais quoi. You know, like there was something not there.
Because it isn't like you can be pretty and tough too, right? Like I think in the past, the tough guys were actually quite pretty still.
Yeah.
Oh, you can know, be like, terrifying. You can be a pretty little femboy and be absolutely terrifying if you are super quick. And you guys ever see knives or any kinds of little weapons? But
did you guys ever see 13th Warrior with Antonio Banderas? Right. So they do it basically Beowulf. But they immediately he's with Vikings. He's not going to keep up with Vikings. So he makes himself a smaller sword, and they laugh at him. Oh, it's a woman's sword or whatever, right? But then it justifies him being able to move faster, you know, and sort of keep up with a bunch of Vikings, right? Which are, you know, very brute force kind of technique. So.
Yeah, you don't want to cram a square peg into a round hole. You want to get the weapon that's right for you. It just makes sense.
Needed to be the long sword because that's the it's part of the whole knight thing, right?
Yeah.
That's fine, but then you have to hire a bunch of people opposite of him that are his size or smaller. You can't have these giant brutes that
They could have smaller sets. They could like shrink the set down by like 5%, so he looks bigger.
Yeah, that's top down style.
I'm gonna write a letter to Ridley Scott right now and tell him it's a total fuck up.
Get with Peter Jackson; he'll show you some techniques to make people look bigger.
Or the guys from Spinal Tap who did the Stonehenge.
I don't know. I don't hate his. I don't hate the casting though. Like I like his acting in it, and I like how he portrays the role very well. Like as a leader, like a spiritual leader, and a guy that's doing stuff. So the beta aspects kind of work for me, but I totally see. Yeah. It's like, he didn't, But I don't know. By the time I'm in it, I'm just kind of like, you know what? I'm happy that he's like bashing that guy in the head with a rock. I believe it. You know.
Well, here's another thing that kind of I don't quite get, and I know that it's intentional, but they celebrate him as a hero after he rides out to meet Saladin's army in front of Kerak. But he gets his ass handed to him. And he's only spared because he was nice to the Sultan guy who he thought was the servant of the other guy. And then later on, when he, you know, fortifies the castle and tries to fortifies Jerusalem and tries to save it and fends off Saladin for a while and threatens to destroy the city if rather than give it to him. I think that was like his only card he had left to play.
He
celebrated as a hero in all these instances for losing.
No. He won the safety of the people inside. The king lost that fight.
He won the people, but when he came back after surrendering Jerusalem, and there was that moment where everybody was clapping him on the back and like cheering him on and stuff, that scene rang hollow to me.
Okay.
I don't think that all those people would have been like, yeah, like they just scored a touchdown or something. Yes, they get to walk out of their love with their lives for the most part, if you trust Salah Hadin, but I don't know, man. It just didn't feel like a victory.
Yeah, maybe not cheering, but I think that was a victory. It was obviously a moral victory.
Yeah. Well, yeah,
the situation was everybody in there was slaughtered, or the knights defend the women and children. So
I completely agree with you on that aspect. It just,
I mean, maybe you're not going to get cheering, but you're also not going to get a swell of violins and horns, you know, like it's a story. So I'm like, okay.
I get it. That's
maybe more like, oh, we don't have to die, guys. And it'd be like, awesome, I'm going to sleep. Like,
yeah, but yeah, you're right.
I'm just going to wake me up when I have to leave the city, please.
It was weird that it was like the flight deck in Top Gun after Tom Cruise lands the plane, you know, like, yeah, you know, like everything's cool again. And then after the Battle of Kerak, where he gets his ass handed to him, I get that his motivation was to protect the villagers or whatever, like the peasants, but I guess it didn't come through in the movie. Like, it seems like the peasants should have been heading towards the castle, and then Orlando Bloom's like protecting them, but it didn't seem as if there was that connection there of that actually happening. Like, they talk about it happening, but it doesn't really seem to happen. And then Orlando Bloom's force gets overwhelmed and spared, but then Orlando Bloom's a hero. So that kind of was a misconnect for me too.
Yeah, I guess show don't tell, because he does say it, but visually it's hard to convey.
They didn't show a bunch of peasants being able to make it to Kerak because of his action.
You want to take an extra 90 seconds for a movie that's 3 hours and 14 minutes long already? Like, I think that when you get down to it, you start cutting like 10 seconds at a time, trying to convey. I can identify if I like with my music and shit. I'm like, okay, how fast can I convey this? Like, I got a piece at the final climax is like an hour and 40 minutes long, and like, well, not everybody's gonna want to listen to an hour and 40 minutes of like really good music coupled with the other stuff. And you're like, okay, well, how can I, like, how do we get from here to here? And what needs to happen? Right. So
see, that's another one of my criticisms is, I feel like there is more that needed to be in this movie to make even more.
I wish he wasn't over the hill. I wish you could go back in time and make miniseries, but with like $1 billion for 10 episodes. You know what I mean? Like, he gets, here's 10 hours to talk about whatever you want. You have final cut. But it is heyday, because he's a bit over the hill, right? I don't think he's worth his salt, but I wouldn't give him extra salt.
Yeah. Well, like you mentioned, like, you know, how do I get from here to here? Like the transitions, like a lot of the transitions from scene to scene in this movie feel like they're not quite, I don't know, transition-y enough. They're just kind of
no
like
Gladiator.
Oh. Yeah. It's like, boom, you're over here all of a sudden, you know, like, no. He gets out of Jerusalem, and then all of a sudden we're looking at him in his village in France.
Yeah,
but there's like, no, you wanna, like, establishing, like, okay, we're not in Jerusalem anymore. Now we're in France. It's just like, boom, you're there.
Like, you want to take Edgar Wright's editing and put it on Ridley Scott's film.
No.
Could you imagine if her face is on her body? It's like, oh, okay. I mean, the guy's got his fault. He's not my favorite director, but man, does he spin a yarn, at least back in the day. I even liked Robin Hood. To an extent, and it's not a great film, but
that's the Russell Crowe one.
Yeah, I liked it. I didn't hate it. It gets pretty dumb at the end. I usually just kind of stop watching it about 90% of the film. When like they're like going to war with France. I'm like, what the fuck is this? Go back to Robin Hood.
So yeah. I have one final note on my side, and then we can do some more final notes on your guys' side. In watching this movie, it reminded me of a game I had on my Nintendo DS like 10 years ago called Age of Empires.
Fuck yes.
And it's like a fun game. It has Saladin. It had King Richard Lionheart and like a French character and some other ones. And you had like different types of infantry and ballistas and siege weapons and all of these things. And you would try to either attack or defend on each of these levels and go through the various campaigns. Now I kind of have a hankering to like try to find that thing.
Dude, just get the new definitive edition. There's a new Age of Empires 2 definitive edition. You can get it on Steam. You can find it even on sale for like $10 or something. And supposedly it's really good.
It's got like the old Tecmo Bowl style graphics, right?
Yeah, I like it.
It's all pretty now. It's all pretty now.
I'm all about hiding in the things I used to like and just pretending all of this shit's not going on. I'm playing old video games, listening to old music, watching old movies.
Living the good old days.
And I got government sponsorship now, so I don't even have to worry about it. I'm just focusing on my propaganda. Do I have time to talk about the Knights Templar real quick?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you know how like some hotels are named Arms? Like the Alec Arms and the whatever Arms? You ever seen that? Y'all ever seen that? So that's named for the lodging houses of the Knights Templar. You come through, it's Arms, right? It's a hotel that's essentially owned by them. And eventually from there, they ended up with ledgers and coffers that would extend across nations. So essentially they became the first international banks, which is interesting because they're like a sort of Satanistic, blasphemic, infiltration of the church. Not that the Roman Empire, the Catholic Empire, was particularly altruistic or not corrupt. Like I think that from day one, like it was kind of a corrupt agency. But this is like sort of a subset of that, which was a very corrupt organization. And then you get the Friday the 13th is when like they were all arrested in France. Gotta look that up. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, they were all executed.
Yeah, and then like 400 years later, Notre Dame was burned down, right? So it's like it's interesting to me that like the negative motivations and the bloodlust and the desire for war for sort of economic reasons correlates to organizations that have like ledgers across nations and an invested interest in like having an army go out and pillage and corrupting the spiritual order of things, like the organizations that we form to try to have a community and spirituality. These sort of people come in and they corrupt it, and they'll say anything, right? Like they're like, oh yeah, I'm totally Christian and I got a big cross on my chest and like I'm totally for Jesus, so I'm just gonna go fucking slaughter a caravan of helpless people. Anyway, I just wanted to point out that they're essentially the first international banks.
We're owned by the banks.
Thanks, Knights Templar.
Yeah, I don't know. Weren't they the bad guys in Assassin's Creed as well?
Probably. I don't know. The movie?
The 158 game series.
Yeah, I don't know which one you're talking about. So
I think they're going to quit when they get to 666, probably. I don't know. I don't know. Fucking
Last Crusade, was that guy a Knights Templar? The guy protecting the Holy Grail?
Yeah, but Spielberg's kind of a propagandist, right? Like, he likes to... I don't know. The Knights Templar were like, but again, it's like, I don't know. Spielberg and Lucas with those films kind of told a fairly fanciful yarn. I don't take too much, you know. There's not a lot of like
accuracy in that.
Yeah, like I don't know. I mean, they're just kind of I think they're just name dropping at that point. I don't know if they were really too interested in actually being accurate in any way. I don't know.
Okay.
So who's the bad guys in this? I don't know. Nazis. We all hate Nazis, right? No one's gonna fuck this up.
All right, Robert. Sorry. Let's go to you for your final comments, and then slide right into final summary and review, if you would.
Sure. Let me take a look here at these notes. Yeah. No, we've gone over all my notes. I took very few notes. I was just kind of enjoying the film. I like how the main character is a builder, and from like an economic standpoint, he kind of sees it as his duty as the owner of this like estate to improve the land. And he digs for water and he irrigates a whole bunch of crops where before there were none. And he really saw it as, you know, what do you do with land? Well, you make it better. You improve it. You homestead it. So that, from my political philosophy standpoint, that's right on to what you should be doing. And then the villains are plunderers. They are people who steal the wealth from others and then call themselves lords and kings and whatnots. And they're just the scum of the earth. These are the leeches, the parasites, where what you want to be doing is building and growing and making the land and using the land to enrich everybody and improving the land. So that was a fun perspective. I enjoyed having the
couldn't have said it better myself.
All right, Robert might be frozen. So if you could leave and come back, Robert, and we'll go to Mike for your final sermon review and give me a number of, I don't know. Is there a number of anything in this that we can use for rating?
I don't like that kind of metric, to be honest. I think I've displayed that by completely throwing it out the window every time I'm on the show. I don't know. I give it 8 Hail Marys out of 7. I think Rob was doing a pretty good job articulating a lot of the ideas. Like I said, it talks a lot about spiritual leadership and the dichotomy that he said about plundering versus cultivating, I think is a central theme to the show, and it's not it doesn't hit you over the head with it. They tell a lot of that stuff visually. For any lacking in the visual narrative, there's just a sheer, just a volume of information to get across. So sometimes they have to make some cuts, but like pretty solid. I mean, yeah, maybe it's not Gladiator, but like there's not going to be a lot of films like Gladiator. I think in his heyday, Ridley Scott told a really great tale. And this one in particular just makes me think about like, the ideas that sort of Western culture is sort of cultivated and this dichotomy between, looting and pillaging and taking and extracting through force, taxes, and how we've refined that process over the centuries, through manipulation versus the kind of person that just takes a stand and tries to cultivate a future, and the idea of leadership being like, how well do you allow others to succeed? How well do you, instill the courage in people and the incentive and motivation to do right by themselves and the people around them? I don't know. I'm pretty impressed watching this the fourth or fifth time now. And what's interesting is like, it's a movie that when I was younger, I liked it, but I didn't really get, some of the nuances of it. And then you get more and more into it and you're like, oh shit, this character is an angel. And like, he's literally waiting for an actual God, and stuff like that. So you get to end up with a yarn that's kind of, a little more fanciful, which I tend to like. I don't know. Yeah. 8 out of 7.
Okay. So more than yeah, the
break,
total.
Break the bank, so to speak.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's pretty good. I think Robert, who was gloating about his high-speed internet coming to his community earlier in the pre-show,
it's coming on horse right now.
Yeah. He's lost his internet access. So I think he was going to give it a pretty good score. And I noticed a lot of the same things that he was mentioning in that the character of Valiant, he's kind of an all around good dude, principled guy. And he's actually trying to improve things, not only for himself, but for the people around him. He's trying to lift them up or inspire. I really did like, that scene at the end where he knights all of these people, and it comes through in the movie. Like all of those actors, like you can see right before he knights them to right after, like they actually look uplifted and more, like they're ready to face the tremendous odds before them. So overall, I think it's a really good movie. I do think it actually could be longer, and it could be maybe polished just a little bit more, so you sort of have like these establishing scenes, so you can kind of understand where you are in relation to, you know, geographically or time, because there are a lot of kind of complicated things sort of going on in this movie. So it's a bit of a muddled mess at first, but I think upon subsequent viewings, it would become easier to understand, and perhaps a lot of that nuance would come out. So I can only imagine how the theatrical cut, which cut out a lot of like the motivating factors, would have been harder to watch, because then it really does just seem even more muddled because you have less reason for these things happening. One of the big things that in my just initial watching that kind of bothered me, which is it just so happens that his wife had just killed herself. And it just so happens that his dad shows up out of the blue on the same day or the next day. It's just like, okay, yeah, I get it. You're telling a story or whatever, but it just seems like such coincidence to get the ball rolling. Like it almost seemed as if Liam Neeson's character had this, he had this purpose in going and reconnecting with his son, and his son was going to be the one, the chosen one to like do some great deed. But we don't ever, that never pays off. We never get like why he thought that, like why he went to go get Baleen and why it was so necessary for him to do so.
Fair enough.
So anyway, but still a good movie, and I'm glad that you brought it up. And if I ever get a solid 3.5 hour block of time where I'm not like cramming to watch another movie for us to do a show on, I will maybe throw this on and try to watch it again. I also have noticed since watching the movie that in the draft cuts of your upcoming album of Mechanical Dream Revolution, episode 5 is what it is, or season 5?
Yeah, this is season 3.
Oh, okay, you're on season 3. So
this is it. I'm going to do something else after this. I mean, I'll do more music, but I'm fucking done with this. Like, this is it.
Well, my point I was trying to get to is I noticed you use some of the lines from this here movie in at least one or more tracks.
Yes.
On the new stuff. So that finally clicked for me. I do really enjoy your stuff and the cultural references that you throw into it. And that's one of the things that I think helps to tell the narrative that you're trying to tell. But some of them I am not familiar with. And so that, I think, means that perhaps your listener needs to sort of be aware of these things to get the point.
I mean, sorry, yes and no. Like, so I've had that feedback, and I've had feedback like the opposite as well. Like, it didn't matter. Like, you don't have to see the movie Soldier, right?
I don't know if you've seen it. Right, yeah.
Well, and you get those lines, you're like, fuck yeah, right? That, what a crazy motherfucker. He's going to go kill, you know? And so what's interesting is that it's sort of, I mean, that's true. Like, for some of the stuff, if it's really a bit of nostalgia baiting, then you will have had to seen it. But like, I'm also trying to say something with the things I'm choosing, and I think they stand on their own for the most part. So if I, you know, if I get that wrong sometimes, you know, maybe that's the case, but I guess, you know, it's improved, but I don't think it's necessary.
Okay. Yeah. I think you hit more than you miss, for sure.
Well, but I don't think it's necessary. Like, I think that like a line from Reign of Fire with Christian Bale and an absolutely jacked up McConaughey, you know, there's a couple of decent lines in that movie that if I just played you the scene, you'd be like, yeah, that guy's fucking awesome, right?
Right, yeah, that's all you need.
Yeah. And so it's like, I mean, I try to make sure that I'm articulating enough with just what it's saying without it being contextual, because I'm recontextualizing it. And then ideally it's also improved and resonates if you've seen the material, and I'm reappropriating it at that point.
Right. So there's a whole nother level if someone is familiar with it.
Yeah. Yeah. But like, okay. I hope it rings true regardless.
Okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. By the way, I didn't give it a score. I'm going to go with the 7.5, 7.5 Knights Templars. So one without a head.
Thanks. Yeah, they should all have no heads.
All and, right. Well,
we should make them rebuild that fucking Notre Dame that they totally burned down.
That was like a couple years ago, right?
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that's going to be our show for tonight. So, Mike, people can find the song that you're going to be sharing with us at lastnighters.com/155. You can also find this episode on the Liberty Movement's YouTube channel. And you can support the show over at lastnighters.com/Patreon. Get pre-show and post-show bonus content. We call the post-show content Kathleen Turner Overdrive, after the band name the Jack Black said in High Fidelity, which is a lot of fun. Good movie. We did that a couple of months ago, or about a year ago now, I think. But yeah. It's been a while. But I just want to say next week we're going to be having Snobby Bobby back on from the Not For Everyone podcast. I Patreon to him, and he Patreons to me. We do a Patreonic circle jerk, so it works out. He sends some money my way, I send the same amount back to him, and the government gets a cut. It's great. It's perfect. But so he's going to be on for Contact, the Matthew McConaughey movie, speaking of him, because the DISH telescope at Arecibo collapsed recently, and it's featured prominently in this film. And so that's why I wanted to do it in a timely manner. So that's what we're going to be doing next week. And Snobby Bobby is, of course, a man, a big fan of Bigfoot and all things conspiracy. So we'll have plenty to talk about on that episode. So I want to wish you guys all a Merry Christmas. This is our Christmas episode. Nothing says Christmas like Legolas defending Jerusalem and the Battle of Helm's Deep 2, as we said in the open. So we'll see you guys all next week. And with that, I'll say Merry Christmas and good night from last night, everyone. Peace out. All right, I'm going to continue the transmission for just another couple of minutes here on the Actual Anarchy podcast. We've been going extra long lately. I think our most recent episode was about 2 hours. Robert's internet is apparently crapped out, so we're not going to get his final score out of him or any commentary in this last portion. But and actually, Mike is stepped away, so I think that's one of the problems with doing longer episodes is that bathroom breaks become difficult. But anyway, we've been going for about an hour and a half already, and I haven't brought up the performance by Edward Norton, and that's what I want to bring up to Mike C. As he sits back down for a conversation about the Ed Norton performance in this. Now, I got to say, when I was watching the movie, I did not know that was Ed Norton.
Yeah, me too. But I just had to step away and rub one out real quick because all that Matthew McConaughey talk.
When he's all jacked. Yeah, jacked.
Just his name. It's just so sexy just to hear this name. Not been drinking too much.
But yeah, he's actually been doing some really good interviews lately, talking about individual responsibility and developing as a person and personal growth and raising parents.
Yeah, he's a little bit right wing, eh?
Yeah, yeah. Or
he's on his way out then? Is he gonna get the Tim Allen and Vince Vaughn treatment?
Yeah, he might now, because he's been saying some things that, you know, make it harder to claim to be a victim about every little thing. But I wanted to bring up the Ed Norton thing because, like I said, I didn't know it was him. But despite him wearing the mask and everything, like, he was just doing so much with just his voice and his eyes.
Yeah, like, fuck, I think Ridley Scott, like, in his heyday, was quite talented at visual, like not perfect, but man, some of the editing and some of the, like, the close-ups, and I don't know, he's got a very unique style, and he must know how to get shit out of his actors, because, like, he got a lot out of actors from, you know, like Gladiator, I say Black Hawk Down, which actually makes me sick to my stomach watching these days, because, again, becoming a libertarian ruins everything. And in this one, yeah, like, oh, sorry, I kind of hijacked. basically, Edward Norton has a great performance in this, and I think that's a lot in part because of the camera work and the directing. But so my story is, I didn't know it was Ed Norton, you know, the first time I watched it, and then I remember looking it up and discovering that, and then I forgot completely. And not until you mentioned it in this podcast did I remember that it was Ed Norton again.
Okay. So you just watched it today.
Yeah, and I watched it minutes before. Like, I shut the movie off and then, like, set up my computer and, like, click the link. So
yeah, now the one thing about his character Baldwin is that there was this fragile piece in the region because of who he was as a man, as a person. He was the king, and he was able to come to terms with Saladin to, like, have this, like, respect of each other to the point of not being aggressive against each other. But it seems like kind of didn't come through in the movie to me that he was necessarily like had a lot of leadership qualities. You know, he didn't like have that presence of people would look up to him and respect his authority. You know what I mean?
Reference with a mask on. And you're talking about Ed Norton, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And just the character.
Okay, so like there's limitations on his mobility and stuff. I think that they conveyed it well in terms of his intellect and how, you know, how he could get things done by decree with the conversations that you see him in. And then when push comes to shove, he shows up to a fight and he leads the army and he negotiates peace personally, even though he's on his deathbed.
Yeah. Cause he knows that that will kill him.
Well, it will certainly be hard. It's a hardship, and it's not going to put years onto his life for sure. I don't know if it's going to kill him per se, but I guess they sort of in the movie they kind of convey it that way. Like,
yeah, I think Tiberius, the Jeremy Irons character, I think that's what he had said. Like, if you go and lead this battle, you know, that's all you've got. You know, you're not coming back from this.
Yeah,
and that's another performance that I didn't realize that was Jeremy Irons because I think of him as much older. Because, you know, he did the voice of Scar in Lion King. And his voice just kind of has that like older.
It really does.
He was also in High Rise and he's rather old in High Rise. But that was.
He's not young. Yeah. He's not young in this movie. Like he doesn't portray a very young person. He portrays like a middle aged burnout kind of. Well, not burnout, but you know what I mean? Like
kind he's kind of veteran of his glories are behind him.
To an extent, but he's also smart from his experience, like his experience. So there's like an attractive, or there's a trade-off there. Like he doesn't seem weak, but he does seem fed up.
Right. Right. Like he's sort of lost that gleam in his eye or the, was it?
Yeah. And then when what the fuck's his name? Legolas. When Legolas refuses the execution of the Knights Templar and the execution of Guy and taking the wife for moral reasons. Irons is pissed off at him the same way his half brother was pissed off at him for not taking the opportunity to leave that he set up. And I thought that was an interesting parallel because it sort of mirrored those two situations. And he's like, no, I have to do my own thing. I'm only responsible for myself. And I can't have that on my conscience, which is interesting.
Yeah.
See, like I would have him killed and then I'd have all those people executed. So he's a better man than me.
Yeah. It did seem like, well, these guys are going to get us all killed by provoking fights with Saladin. So I don't know. You could almost justify it. You know, like this is a defensive thing.
Yeah. Well, it's a bit like nuking Hiroshima, I guess.
Not quite that. Anyway. We should wind this down and get into some Kathleen Turner Overdrive. I don't think Robert's going to be coming back. I sent him a message and he has yet to see it. So he
can I do one really quick last note?
Sure. Yeah, go for it.
David Thewlis. He plays the the guy with a black tunic and the white cross. It's always saying like, really well, no, like he's always saying like really weird spiritual stuff and he's like I don't have a lot of faith in religion and stuff. If you watch this movie again, he's literally an angel. Like he literally in the film shows up with no way of getting to the position where he talks to Orlando Bloom and then disappears. Like you don't notice it the first couple times you watch the movie because they do it so well, but he's literally like an angel with a touch of God. And he comes in and has like this divine influence. And he says shit like you're in the hands of God now. Or I don't think Jesus would approve slaughtering civilians. I'm just saying. So anyway, watch it again. And when you've got 3.5 hours to kill, I don't know. We'll probably be all like just getting food rations from the government soon. You don't need a job. Like you can just watch movies all day. It's going to be great.
Yeah, yeah. Get food rations, get plumped up, get those hover chairs like in WALL-E.
Yeah. And then we can just like grind up prisoners and eat them. And
yeah, so in the green, they were referencing all these other movies, and that's our dystopian future that we're all stepping into.
I personally think this is the greatest opportunity in the history of humanity for freedom, and it's up to us to take that opportunity because the for the lack of a better word, Satan has overplayed his hand. It's and all the race shit and all the sexist shit just goes away because everybody's in the same boat and they're being oppressed by the same inconsistent authority that wants to take your rights away. And a lot of people across the world are not having it. So it's interesting to me that like we've kind of come down to freedom versus slavery, not black and white, not man versus woman, Muslim, Christian. You know, it's just kind of nice that for once we can kind of just decide whether or not we want to be free or in chains. So
you're white pilled. This is interesting because it does seem like we are at a very dark period. And I think that the narrative is such with the gatekeepers who control that narrative, they're preventing people from seeing the other side or seeing people resisting all of this lockdown and totalitarian stuff to keep blinders on you and make you feel as if we are isolated and we are all subjected to this and there's nothing that we can do about it. So it's interesting to hear you say that you're seeing a silver lining. Michael Malice has also said that he sees this as a great opportunity and that things are looking up in the near future as a result of this. And I can see some of that. Like, yeah, they're certainly showing the evil that they are in a very bold way, but they also have a lot of people buying into it and believing it and policing others based on their beliefs. So it's a little bit scary. It's like maybe I'm still seeing the darkness and you're seeing, you know, the darkest part before the dawn and you're seeing that crack of dawn. But anyway, maybe that'll be the, you know, the Christmas message for everyone here. The actual energy.
Not too shabby. It is in line. We're entering the age of Aquarius, right? There are going to be some changes to the way things work. They don't have to be negative. It's the winter of the great celestial here. That's like whatever, 15,000 years, 15,000 years, whatever, like 2,000.
Oh, years okay. You're getting beyond the dark winter stuff from Joe Biden.
That is interesting that all this shit lines up. Their rhetoric lines up with what is happening celestially, which is interesting to me because, like, I don't have to believe in that for them to believe in it. I don't have to worship. I don't have to even think the devil's real for them to fucking, you know. Drink
for them to line their stuff up.
Adrenochrome and all that shit. All the, like, I don't have to go down that rabbit hole for them to seek power in that, right? But what is interesting is that, like, the cataclysms throughout history have always sort of happened on these sort of intersections. So it's kind of like we're on a highway and we're gonna merge with traffic. So we got to kind of watch out what's going on. Kind of getting off topic. Anyway, so my point is that change isn't necessarily a negative thing, and it's like. We can move forward with the progressive stuff without, you know, losing complete structure and control over human society, you know, like the way they sort of given us. Am I making any sense?
I think you're making a little bit of sense. Yeah. Okay. And I think that a lot of people saw this happening in 2012, you know, it was supposed to be the end of the Mayan calendar and all these other cycles and the X planet was supposed to be like on the plane of, you know, with the sun and the moon and whatever.
I just mean I'm past this point of like SJWs are ruining our movies. I'm like, well, yeah, but like also Hollywood is pandering to an audience. And yeah, SJWs are ruining our movies. But like the reason they're able to sell these ridiculous Marxist ideas are because there's legitimate grievances. And even if it's a 1% grievance for a 99% horseshit, you know, sort of implementation of, you know, use, leveraging of that grievance, we should, you know, if we can just figure out how to address that 1% grievance, we can probably completely negate, you know, all of this identity politics and start looking at the, you know, and like I said, I feel like they've overplayed their position because, like, it's really inconsistent that Walmart's open but your local place isn't, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, we should probably end this here, but I do like the hopeful message at the end. And Robert has returned back to his home because he records his show elsewhere, and he has internet at home, but not at the place. So he will not be joining us for the Kathleen Turner Overdrive, available for our Patreon supporters at actualanarchy.com/Patreon. And this has been episode 212 of the show. You can find the show notes more at actualanarchy.com/212. You can find Mike's previous appearances on there. You can also find the link to his song that he's released for this very special Christmas gift, and we wish you all the Merry Christmas. And also check out the Christmas star. It's the Saturn and Jupiter in alignment. It's supposed to be I think on the 21st is when it's like perfectly in alignment, but right now, And for a few days after, they're going to be close enough to where it's going to be one huge bright star, and they call it the Christmas star. So check that out, and check us out next week for Contact with our buddy Snobby Bobby. And with that, we wish you a Mechanical Dream Revolution Christmas. Peace out, everyone. Maximum Free.
Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do-do. Do-do-do-do. Do-do. Do-do-do-do.